Now, we've got a really interesting topic. This is a really exciting subject. It's an invisible piece of cybersecurity that nobody really sees or talks about very much. So, James Sherlow, welcome to the Cyber Show.
Thank you very much, and thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Application programming interfaces. How would we sum that up in a few words? What are they?
I guess in a few words, it's a link into an application that allows you to consume it in a way that you would like to consume it, rather than you being told. Let's say a good example is if you've got an app or a web interface, that's telling you how to consume it, whereas underneath that is the programmable piece that allows you to decide how you may want to consume something. You know, the good of API development is huge and massively competitive advantages and things like that. But so you don't want to slow that down, but you do want to look at all the behavior accessing it.
I've got a bunch of definitions, and I've split them up into things that I think are strong facts, as it were, definitions, things that are claims, and some things that are clearly slop. Here's a prize piece of AI slop on the subject of APIs. My opinion after just reading a few of those was that if you were to ask any two people having a conversation about APIs, there's a 10% chance that they're both talking about the same thing because the word is somewhat overloaded.
Yeah, a lot of terms in technology, they become loosely connected to reality, especially acronyms. There are so many acronyms across the entire business that there can be some assumptions about what that is, what it makes out to be. So yeah, for sure, I can imagine there's plentiful of slop out there, I'm sure.
James, you're going to tell us all today how terribly insecure that is and how there's a whole world of cyber threats in our APIs. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, I'm sure it's not that bad, but there are certainly some challenges that we all need to be aware of, for sure.
There's all these very dramatic things with AI, with insecure websites and insecure client-side applications. But I guess what I would liken it to is mushrooms and mycelia and the kind of hidden natural world that's running everything behind the scenes. That's what application programming interfaces are. They're a bottom of the iceberg that runs so much information systems.
Yeah, I think, first of all, the fact that APIs are ubiquitous, I think, is definitely true. It is in our daily lives, because every time you use a phone and an app on a phone, you're using an API. And many, many cars these days are pretty much an API on four wheels. So I think in our daily lives, we're using APIs whether we know it or not. And that proliferation is just becoming more and more. I mean, if you use banking solutions on your phone as well, you're using APIs. So it is indeed ubiquitous. But there is also, there's not just APIs of consumer to application, but there's also APIs between application to application. So machine to machine. And this is where some dangers can come from.
Fantastic. We're going to delve into that in some great depth really soon. Would it be fair to say that if we went back maybe 20 years, computers, information systems are already a huge part of life, but are absolutely completely hidden? Almost nobody had any legibility into the workings of systems that ran banking, that ran government decision-making, procurement, things like that. So they were always, or have for a long time, been part of our everyday lives. But something's happened, and it's happened around this term API, which is to do with selectively exposing parts of that hidden computational working of society. And that's very deliberate, with attendant upsides and downsides. For example, say meteorological data is published as an open API for anybody to go and read the temperature is in a particular town or what wind speed is or look at a weather forecast. That's amazing. That's a real public service. And then at the same time, there are pieces of computing infrastructure that are being exposed, which is really not a good idea that they are. Is that something you recognise?
Yeah, I think like you say, it's a good opacity or sharing of information. And back in the day, information was shared, but the information that was shared was very controlled because it was through the user interface by which you were presented. Now you're being shared a whole bunch of information that you can access via an API, which is allegedly secure, but not always. And that's part of the challenges that we're facing. And you talked about some good examples of, let's say, benign information, potentially, if you collect the weather, there's not too much you can do with that. But if you take the other end of the spectrum, which is, for example, if I'm using my mobile phone and I go abroad, all of my roaming information, everything else now is done via an API. It's not done over what was the proprietary SS7 network where computers were running back in the day. It's now running over a public network using an API with all my information and all my records, potentially available, personal information available over an API. So you're absolutely right. The visibility and the richness of data that is now being exposed is on a different level to what it was. And it is now almost like, here's everything. And the API then selectively says, what do I actually need? But the default of the application is, I'll give you everything. And then you selectively take what you actually find useful for yourself. But unfortunately for an attacker, that might be everything.
This selection you've got to there, James, is something that we've touched on before, whitelisting versus blacklisting. Fundamentally different philosophies in security to expose everything and then selectively block, as is happening with large language models, guardrails, put a layer on the top of it to try and kind of plug the holes. The opposite philosophy is whitelisting, allow listing, to only allow those elements which you've explicitly and reflectively decided they're okay to expose. You're saying that how APIs are constructed and deployed is this much weaker enumerating badness, as Marcus Renoum calls it.
Yeah, I think it doesn't really matter, regardless of APIs or whatever technology, have been in security for some time. You've had this argument around the positive and negative security models. Always the positive security model is the way that you would like to go, because it's very difficult to define what you don't know, whereas it's very easy to define what you do know. Positive security models always outweigh negative models. The challenge comes when you're trying to build an open infrastructure like you are with APIs and LLMs and other such technologies, where actually what you want to do is create openness. And if you want to define that openness through a positive security model, that's actually pretty tricky, because the world is so huge in that positive security model that actually you get to a challenge where it's undefinable, in fact. So this is where there has to become a new model, which is to work alongside APIs and actually become a frictionless technology that integrates closely with the API to then detect things in real time and understand and do more behavioral analysis and move away from allow list or deny list and move more towards a synthesis and working in harmony.
So we have a general form of a problem that exists in all areas of computing. I'll pick an example from games, sandbox open world games. And I was involved many years ago in the development of algorithms for building these worlds on the fly. Turns out that given limitless possibilities, especially with generative technologies, it's unnavigable. There's no map of it. And so there's no way to enumerate it. There's no way to understand what its limits are. And when people experience it and they go into it, quite often that can be a disaster, because in a sense, it's constraints that define our world and give us value, especially in creativity and things like that. Without constraints, can you think of any examples of open systems and some of the attendant problems that come with them because of that lack of constraint?
I mean, the obvious and most topical one are things like ChatGPT or DeepSeek, where there's these AI chatbots, if you want to call them that. The information is allegedly unlimited, it's boundless. And in theory, these things can train themselves so they can start to understand different nuances of the way in which you ask questions, and you can be iterative, which means that therefore the opportunities are boundless. And that can be for good or it can be for bad. And that's where the challenges start to lie, is like, I might want to, for example, do some questions and to write some code in order to consume an API. And there's nothing wrong with that. And I think that's a really good use of the technology. Whereas someone else might want to use it for malicious activities in the world. And that's where the boundless becomes questionable in everyday life. So that's a great example of the good or the bad. And it can be depending on which way you use it.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
It's an unavoidable question of what is good and what is a bad use. Who gets to say that? Once you put a system out there which you present as open, and you say the value in this is that you can use it for whatever you want, and then suddenly you start overlaying values, intentions on top of that. A word that we see often with APIs is intentions. Somebody has a data set or they have an algorithm that performs an operation of value, but they also, along with that, they have an intention. They have an idea of how the end user is going to use that and what is allowed and what is not allowed. And I think that that's philosophically problematic, because Lawrence Lessig kind of idea that code is law. The point is that by writing the code, you're supposed to put these constraints in how people use it. And it also, you're supposed to then present limits of that through some kind of user interface, through some UI, which guides and tells the person what are their expected actions, what data can they explore, what operations can they perform. But then we have this tension with these sort of open systems where we say, well, just throw them out there and see what people do with them. And quite often what they then do with them is not what you intended, it's not what you wanted, and it's not in your interests as the provider of that system. I'll give you an example from my own experience. I was in a company that was first on the ground in comparative shopping, gave you the best price. And back in those days, we called it deep linking or scraping. I'm sure you're very well aware of politics and the history behind all of this stuff. The merchants didn't want, you know, anyone to get the best price. So very quickly, we got into an interesting ethical conundrum with the merchants, who on the one hand really, really loved us because they wanted us driving traffic to their sites, right? On the other hand, they were really annoyed that we created a free and fair open market and were using their information to do so. But that essential tension has never gone away. It's still there in everything that we see online. And I call it the cake and eat it problem, is that lots of commercial vendors, they have an idea of how they want people to use their product because that is the most profitable thing for them. It turns out that there's a dozen other ways that people are going to use that API, that product, to create value for themselves. And why shouldn't they, naturally? And what we end up with is this war between providers and users, in which the providers are constantly playing cat and mouse with people who are using their APIs, often creating more value than they had, you know, created themselves, which is then like a bittersweet pill, isn't it? Because somebody came along and kind of stole your lunch. It's a really, really difficult area politically. Am I right?
Yeah, I think so. And it's interesting, the example you give is like, it's still going on in different guises. I've worked with another insurance company in different kind of insurance, but it's still a very competitive market. And of course, you know, and they specialize in, part of their intellectual property is not only the pricing, but the description of their plans and the way in which they describe them. And therefore the value that they're deriving is, they see that as an intellectual property, but of course it has to be open to everyone. So it's a challenge. And then I've seen it also in secondhand car sales. Where they're scraping all the information, the advert, the description, everything else, and they're selling it somewhere else. Mike, you said they've iterated, they've done some marketing, they've then been able to get this product out to more people and sell the vehicle faster than the original site it was listed on. And wow. So they're essentially taking all the commission and all the sales for that information. And so there's a whole bunch of things that you can do. But I think, you know, where I come to on this is that as a security vendor, we're definitely not there to answer the ethics. It's more about the value of the data and the data that's being taken and how it's being taken. And so that's where we get involved, where actually, if you have sensitive data, whatever that is, and that intellectual property could be the description, or it could be actual PII data, whatever it happens to be that's important to the business, that's what we need to protect and make sure that that's not being stolen. Being used, yes. Stolen, no. Because that when it becomes theft, then that's actually a security concern versus an ethical concern of, can you take my data? Well, there's no ethics involved there. It's just you're taking my data. You know, do something about it. So I think that's where security steps in, albeit there are a ton of ethical challenges and concerns and questions, but I don't think that's the role of security to jump in there.
Back to the ethics out, there's good ethics, and we'll assume we've arrived at some policy, and now our problem is to enforce that policy. So I'm going to move on, talk about security and security mechanisms. Maybe here's a nice place to start. One of the definitions in APIs that I see Protocols that enable software applications to communicate with each other by exchanging data. And I thought, well, there's a tautology or redundancy right away. Applications communicate with each other by exchanging data. Well, of course they do. I mean, any communication is an exchange of data. And so what I see the author or whatever wrote that is trying to bring out there is there's this other concept. They're trying to split communication from data as if data was something else. So we often talk about data when we talk about data sets, you know, bulk data sets, things that are gigabytes in size. And then we forget that communication, which is all the scaffolding to arrange for the transfer of that data, the link layer and the transport layer and so on, all of the metadata associated, the timing, the things that in security we call data, but commercial traders don't call data because it's invisible to them. A lot of the time, APIs are leaking data unwittingly in how they operate. Does that make sense to you? And do you have experience with that or any examples, James?
Yeah, it's a great point. So, and I agree with you, data is data. Whether it's a small amount or a large amount, it's still data. I think that's a nice way of putting it, because there's no distinction there. And actually, you know, I remember back in the old days when I used to work for in a firewall security company, the old way in which people would secure things was through port and protocol. Mm. And you could actually just run a small tool on a terminal and you could say, please run this over port 80. And of course, everything ran over port 80 because it was the internet.
Yeah.
And then you could exfiltrate whatever you liked out of port 80 because it was open. And that's how it used to be secured. And that was in before then, of course, that was solved by moving more towards application knowledge and going up the stack to understand, oh, okay, that's not web traffic. That's actually something completely different. But in that phase, what you would exfiltrate was small amounts of data, because that's what you could get away with as well. You'd go under the radar, no one would trigger volumetric detection, and so therefore you could exfiltrate small amounts of data at a time. So it could have come from a big data set, but like you rightly pointed out, it was a small communications. But moving more towards APIs now, of course, because you have machine-to-machine communication, as you highlighted, and also human-to-machine communication, you've got all kinds of comms going on. And actually, the proliferation of APIs has become huge, because what's happening is, and this is brilliant, the agility which APIs offer is the fact that now I can have a developer developing in C, a developer developing in Java, someone else in whatever language they want to, and then they just expose the information via API. So it doesn't matter. So now we don't have to necessarily hire specialists in one language to create a monolith. We can actually have specialists in different areas and they can write in different languages. That is fantastic. And now they're offering these interfaces to allow bits of the application to communicate in order to present the ultimate result, whatever that happens to be. That could be car insurance, pet insurance, it could be your phone, it could be a car, whatever it happens to be. But then in creating all of those opportunities to communicate, the bit that's really hard is documenting it all. Of course, that should be an automated process as well. I'm not suggesting someone sits there and writes documentation for all of their APIs. To answer your question in a rather long-winded way is like, then what they're doing is they're exposing what we term as shadow APIs. And shadow APIs are APIs that are not documented, not expected to be part of the application, maybe not deliberately coded even, but are just available. And then what happens is through reconnaissance, attackers find these and they target them for a couple of key reasons. One is they're typically unauthenticated, therefore they can get access to them. So that's job number one, done, tick. Second is they're often not monitored. Fantastic. So as an attacker, I can now go under the radar and I've identified this shadow API. And third, which is less common but can happen, is that they will then expose sensitive data amongst that. So not just any data, but sensitive data in and amongst that API. So what you've got there is what we call the Holy Trinity, which is a shadow API, it's unauthenticated, and it's exposing sensitive data. And that is way more common than one may think. And a lot of these leaks of data and information that you might see publicly, if you dug deeper into them and went under the covers a little bit, what you'd find is it was probably a shadow API that was unauthenticated, that was leaking sensitive data. It's so common, it's unbelievable.
When we see this presented in the press, usually it's couched in terms of somebody left a database exposed or something like that, and the immediate kind of chorus of disapproval on Hacker News or whatever will be, oh, what a bunch of idiots, surely people know how to secure a database in 2025. But in reality, you're saying there might be all kinds of levels of indirection behind that. It's actually a perfectly secured database and a perfectly secured web server, a perfectly secured network. They've done all their homework. They've got absolutely great security on all, at the systems level. What is scary about APIs is that they present a tunnel that literally comes right into the heart of a running process at the very center of your system, that somebody can recon that, they can burrow in through the bad parser or something like that, you know, a bad regular expression, and suddenly, boom, they bypassed everything you've got, and they're right in the middle of your system. APIs seem like a very, very dangerous tool in computing, right?
Yeah, it's a great observation you make, that despite all of the fantastic security products in place, you can go right the way through them. Why? Why is that? It's because you're doing something that's allowed. Why would they stop you? Why would they stop you? A lot of signature-based systems will look at it and they'll say, nope, don't match any of my signatures, you're allowed through. Totally. A firewall will go, looks like the application that I'm expecting to see, perfect, through you come. And like, they're all ushering you in, saying, in you come, you're doing everything absolutely right. And this is the challenge that APIs can present. You've done something in your APIs, you configured something slightly wrong, and then if someone asks the right question of your API, the API goes, oh, I can't answer that, and gives you an error.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
And the way an API should give you an error is it should send you back a nice, neat message, a 403 or something that says, excuse me, thanks very much for your inquiry, but I can't help you. Instead, what happens is it sends out a 500 error. And in the worst case, can dump you a whole stack trace because you've just blown up the API. In some of those situations, it will then expose information that you're not expecting. So in the worst case, and we talked about databases earlier, you know, I've seen one of those where I got the stack trace and inside of there was the username and password to the backend database, statically configured. So that's where, again, another way in which you're ushered in, like you rightly said, right into the core of the network, and the core of the network can give you some information that just wasn't expected.
Totally. Let's stick with this topic of failure mechanisms, because I think this is fascinating and I think our listeners enjoy this too. Well, what goes wrong? Ed mentioned one the other day, which was people just forgetting their .gitignore files. And so when they'd uploaded stuff to GitHub or other repositories exist, they found in the middle of them like private keys and all kinds of stuff like that that had just been kind of dumped into the source code. Also, developers leaving debug code in there. And I can remember cart, when it fails, you want to know why, and like you want to see the stack trace in your browser, right? Because that's where you're working at the point at which you're really tweaking a system that's almost finished. So all of that debug code, if you can trigger it, it's not been stripped out. What other kind of crazy failure mechanisms have you seen?
Yeah, well, the first thing I'd like to say is that when you get a failure as an attacker, or what some people don't recognize, and they go, oh, it just failed, it's no big deal. But actually, that's a fail open scenario. That means if I'm an attacker, I've now communicated with your backend. I might have only got an error, but I've initiated communications. What that will do to me if I'm an attacker is just encourage me and go, oh, that's brilliant, fantastic. Thank you very much. I can see already that your system's not programmed correctly. Yep. So now I've got all the encouragement I need to keep going and keep asking more and more different questions. And that's where these failure scenarios start to kick in, is because actually the APIs are connected to all sorts of other systems. And I've seen dumps of user information where you ask the wrong question and it goes, I don't know, so I'm just going to give you what I do know. And it's like, and it sends you a whole lot of data. And so these different failure mechanisms are sometimes very, very painful and can give out more and more information than anyone's ever expecting.
You're listening to The Cyber Show.
Maybe let's touch on people using the wrong technologies for the job they're doing. Just to give a bit of background, there's some standard, the idea that basically it's all XML-based REST, SOAP, things like object access and object management, the usual sort of CRUD application, read them and update them and delete them and all that kind of thing. What you're basically doing with those objects or documents or whatever, to browse them, read them, write them. Some people at sort of management level will say, we would like to have an API, we'd like to partner with another company and we'd like to give them a route into our data. And that's as far as they care about seeing it. That then goes maybe to a junior dev who grabs that and just boshes a very thin veneer over the top of that. For many libraries that are very easily accessible these days, you can take a data set and you can just grab a library and say, basically, I'm going to expose that data set through this. But the problem there is they've chosen the wrong tool for the job. What they really needed to do was to simply coordinate state, or to, it should be all read-only or whatever, but they've allowed it to write. And how do people find the right technology for creating partnerships, data connections, when they don't really have a good model of how the intended user, what am I trying to say here? They don't really know what they're doing, right? There's a lot of that around, I think, and people are just putting technologies on that they don't really understand.
I think really then in that phase, what you've got to do is you've got to shift all the way back to the left. So what you need to do is it's difficult for you to always decide what information it is that you actually want to give, as you rightly pointed out. So therefore, at the very beginning, when you're developing your API, build the documentation automatically. So put that in your build process. That documentation will then give in a consumable manner the APIs in which you're exposing and what the purpose of those APIs are. At the same moment, that would also feed into a security testing tool that would then test each of those APIs that are documented for common failures across the OWASP top 10. So it would say, do you have authentication? Is this a shadow API? Is it exposing sensitive data? All of those good questions that are in the OWASP top 10, you'd check it before it gets published, and you'd check, and you'd have the APIs checked in automatically into documentation. So then the consumer can then imagine what they want to take. So they may want to take some of the application, none of it, all of it, whichever pieces they want, but they'd have full documentation from them that says, this is what you, if you request, this is the information we're going to give. And then they can write a wrapper around it. What I've seen is the flip side of that, where someone didn't write the API correctly from the ground up. And then what you get is this kind of like middle layer. And in the middle layer, someone's doing that freak, for want of a better phrase, where they're basically saying, right, here's an API gateway, for example. That API gateway is now going to publish this functionality to you. And then what the API gateway does is it rewrites everything on the back end to try and fix the inadequacies of the application that's actually being exposed. And at that point, then now what you've got is split ownership, and that's going to bring in complexities.
These are great points. What I think we'll move on to quite soon, James, is to talk about automatic security testing. I presume you've got some great bots that fuzz and probe APIs to kind of figure out what's going on. It'd be nice to know about those, and also how you might bring in language models and intelligence type ideas to probe APIs and kind of figure out where they're going wrong. And also where you might put them on the server side in a monitoring role, as you said, in real time, a behavioral model rather than an access model. And I think for me, that's where the rubber really hits the road. I've been working on a writing project and research project on trust. And trust is an absolutely fascinating topic. I think it's right at the very heart of security. When we abstract things, abstraction is a process of deciding not to know, selective forgetting. And as we build these trust relationships and the world gets faster and faster, they go out of date much quicker. At the core of many security models is identity, and it's rather a rubbish thing. Identity is not a great thing for doing authorization and access control and stuff, because identity is so easily forged. It's so ephemeral. whereas behavior is something that you can see right there in front of your eyes. So I think that there's a great future in behavioral models, which maybe don't even care about identity. They allow anonymous systems to work quite well, because what you're looking at is what the user is doing. And if they start doing wrong things, then you throw them off.
That is very naughty. Whoever wrote that is a naughty boy.
The old-fashioned system administrator that used to be logging people out when they were being naughty. Is that where you're going with some of your security ideas?
Yeah, I think it's a great point, because we see identities being stolen a lot. And the reason they're being stolen a lot is then to be reused in order to exfiltrate systems, be that the one that they've just exfiltrated or a completely different one where they're going to test those credentials somewhere else. So when you're looking at behavior, I'll give you a simple example. You know, you talked a little bit about the car insurance world earlier, so let's go back to that one. If I'm looking for car insurance, I'm going to go onto the site, I'm going to have a look around, I'm going to say, okay, yeah, it's this plan, it's that plan, I'm going to start to build my plan, and at the end of it, it's going to give me some kind of quote. Whereas what I could do as an attacker, go straight to the last step, and I've skipped out all the previous steps. This is a very obvious non-human behavior, just to make it nice and easy, is like, then that's really weird. No human would ever skip out all those front steps and go straight to the end. That's a very simple example. There are, of course, many nuanced and much more sophisticated behavioral models. So then what systems can do is they can start to look at that behavioral access and try to do it in a frictionless way. You don't want to put hurdles or boundaries in the way of APIs and API development, because the good side of API development is an agile, fast time to solution.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
The other slight challenge you've got is that whilst you want to be server-side, you can't always go on the server itself, because you might not know where it is. So you also have to be able to have intelligent models in which to identify the traffic flows, without, again, being intrusive. And that's part of the secret source of, like, the discovery element, because we talked about earlier about positive and negative security models. But the very first step, if you take a step back, is what's going on? What's actually happening? And yep. What does it look like? What do traffic flows look like? And then doing that behavioral analysis. And then, like you say, abstracting yourself away from specific user information and saying, okay, does this behavior adhere to and look like the behavior that I would expect from the application?
And that's a very, very difficult task, isn't it? For all reasons that you've already said, I think, James, that balance of monitoring versus intrusion, also speed. How do you make decisions fast enough? I mean, it may be that someone just wants to grab a private key, and by the time you realize that they've taken that 128 bytes of data away, it's too late. And also what you're signaling during that process. Anyone that just uses computers in a more advanced way, say if you're using a text-based browser or you're going in through a non-standard route, immediately the system is terrified and shuts itself down and tells you access denied, suspicious activity. On the one hand, that's going to create a lot of problems. If you've got too many false positives and you're oversensitive, you're shutting down all your customers. On the other hand, if you give anything else back, now you've got a side channel for probing, so somebody can kind of figure out, okay, well, that didn't work, but maybe this will.
Like some of those, you know, identify how many traffic lights there are or bicycles there are, or just, you know, get in the way. And they don't actually solve any security problem at all. All they do is annoy regular users, and attackers, they just send it off to a solving solution, 2 cents per solve. Actually, all you've done is created a VIP service for attackers and an annoyance for good users. So we steer clear that it's just not a security solution. It's an annoyance for humans and nothing for attackers. It's not just looking at behavior, but then adding in, you talked a little bit about this earlier, adding in deceptive responses. So actually you can pretend to be the API and you can give misbehaving actors misinformation. And then one of the worst things you can do is, if you're dealing with advanced attackers, is if you block them, that's almost the worst thing you can do. Because what happens is they immediately go, oh, I'm blocked, let me try another method. And so then eventually they're going to iterate and they'll probably get to something that you can't block anymore. So they'll find something. Whereas if you send them deceptive responses, it's much harder for them to figure out. And actually, dealing with the adversaries isn't always about actually just stopping them. It's about often breaking their business model. We talk a lot about this because actually what they're doing is they're trying, typically they're doing this for profit of some description. And they're probably writing code on their side as well to do this exfiltration. So if you're increasing the cost on their side, then suddenly they're going to go, maybe this is too difficult. Try somewhere else.
Great points. They're very well put. You have a background in cybersecurity and you work for a company called Sequence.ai.
That's correct, yes.
.ai. Is that what all the cool kids have now? .ai? Is that sort of mandatory?
Yeah, I mean, can't you tell I'm a cool kid?
So yeah, totally. You're down with the kids with the .ai. We're dusty old .comers. Yeah, we live in a camper van. So how much machine learning and attendant technologies are you actually playing with at the moment?
Yeah, it's a good question, isn't it? And there is a bit of hype. And obviously, we're a 10, 11-year-old business, so we did .ai some time ago, not in this current hype phase.
Okay, cool. Good point.
So we're not just riding on the back of a bandwagon here. We're genuinely using behavioral-based analysis. And we actually use both supervised and unsupervised ML models. A combination of the two gives you the best kind of power. Cool. So we do a lot of training on live data. We train what good looks like. A really simple example is, what does a good browser look like? And it's better then to have the positive security model, which you touched a bit on earlier. So I can say, what does Chrome look like? What does Safari look like? What does Edge look like? When it's accessing any site, doesn't matter which, you don't have to be site specific. This is a behavioral based analysis tool of what Chrome looks like. Because the first thing that we know about attackers is that the tools that they use may come from some kind of toolkit and therefore won't behave exactly like a browser behaves. So if you straight out of the gate go, okay, this is what a good browser looks like, you've already caused a massive problem for any attacker because then they have to do some excellent coding to look exactly like the specific browser that they're coming in. Another great example for an unsupervised model can be seasonality. What kind of regular patterns a customer has within their data flow, but the way in which it's accessed over periods of time, whatever time periods that is. So learning seasonality and the way in data that's inside is another great indication, because I know it seems obvious, but as soon as there's a little blip or a spike, we catch things like reconnaissance in these blips and spikes of the way in which the seasonality might change. And catching reconnaissance is fantastic because then you've already got them. It's like, great, you know what they're coming for next and everything else. Of course, you may not always catch that, but you might then catch the actual attack itself just through those kind of models. So that's a couple of examples of both a supervised and unsupervised model. We use various types, but the point is one model isn't enough. You've got to come at it from lots of different angles and then push that information together. Unlike a signature, which is, if you match a signature, that's definitely a match. The same isn't true with behavior. What you've got to do is you've got to build a picture and say, okay, I've got this piece of information, I've got that piece of information, add it all together. Okay, that equals bad. Maybe it's suspicious, maybe it's okay, but it's below the level that you're setting, so therefore I'm going to allow it. So that's where behavioral has that kind of gray area, but you need to have lots of inputs in order to be sure that you're not going to create a whole ton of false positives, which would do no one any good.
And this is how we do this as human beings, multifaceted, multi-level, taking in all kinds of information about body language, about odor, about where people's eyes go, about their tone of voice, whether their story connects together and makes sense. And then suddenly you get the spidey feelings or that kind of trusting feeling or whatever. It's a complex dynamic and interaction that's extended in time. This is fuzzy, there isn't access denied, black or white failure. So this is a very, very different model. Obviously, it requires much more complex software to do. You said a little bit about how you develop it. You work on case studies, you look at live data, trying to train your machines to see things that don't look right. And if you see something that doesn't look right, see it, say it, sorted. What does sorted look like? How do you intervene? What are your products and where do they sit? Is this firewall technology? Or is this coded into the API during development of the API or what?
So we sit in a number of different places because, again, we think that one size doesn't fit all. So actually we have the capability to go inline and take action directly ourselves. There's a significant advantage of that. Or we can do sensitive passive installations where we're not inline. So I'll give you some great examples. We can go inline like a WAF or a firewall at the perimeter edge. That's the obvious place at which to defend APIs. That's assuming you have a perimeter, which is a huge assumption these days. Then, of course, we can work on the servers, but that wouldn't typically be a regular server. It might be a Kubernetes environment that's got a whole bunch of microservices running, where there's huge amounts of APIs east, west, and north, south, meaning staying within the cluster and also exiting the cluster. We then have the capability to instrument or tell via an API an alternative platform to take an action. So we might ask the firewall or the WAF to take an action or the load balancer to take an action on our behalf because we've identified something nefarious that is considered to be worth taking an action on. So we typically try not to be engaged in the application level itself. But one of the things we do is I talked about deceptive responses. The other thing we can do is inject a header. This is really cool because actually we inject a header only to the backend API service. So we're not integrated into the API service per se, but we are adding a header that says, hey, this looks suspicious. Do you want to do anything about it? A really good use case for this is actually, we talked about earlier how capture can be really annoying, but people still need to authenticate themselves to certain applications. So we can inject a header and say, we're not sure this really is the person they say they are. So why don't you initiate multi-factor authentication to that specific user? So then they get challenged and they're like, oh, that's a bit annoying, but at least it's with their information. They don't have to go and ask how many traffic lights there are or something like that. They can verify it is them and then they can continue to work along their merry way. But that only happens, of course, if they've done something what we deem to be suspicious. This is a really nice solution, especially for that gray area where you might go, I don't want to block them. I don't want to ship them off to another location. Let's give them a chance to say they are who they say they are. And I think that's also a nice way of doing it.
Adaptive and measured and proportionate security is a bit of a holy grail when you go through the airport. I mean, it's absolutely unworkable unless there was some kind of human eyes on there making decisions and saying, you know, we've got to let like 99% of people through, otherwise it just doesn't work. But perhaps we could even use random samplings. And you're inconveniencing far fewer people. For the vast majority of people, it looks completely transparent. They don't even see the security. That's great. The danger, of course, and this goes with all security models, we might also look at bias. I think in a couple of weeks, we're interviewing somebody from the IEEE on a new set of directives, actually, quite a powerful set of directives on algorithmic bias and what governments and organizations are going to have to do. Well, let's go back to the case of the browser. I mean, like the suspicious browser, that would be me. I'd use something like, you know, Emacs or W3M or, you know, and there's so many sites that are just throwing me out. They hate me. So I'm always on the wrong side of that. You know, that's already legacy and old fashioned to me. That is, it's identity based, but it's archetypal identity based. So it's fundamentally prejudicial. And I often think to myself, well, if I was any kind of an attacker at all, I wouldn't look like this, you know. I wouldn't be that dumb, right? I'm obviously using a text-based browser for speed, efficiency, security, privacy, all of these things. Like, I wouldn't dream of using Chrome for a lot of things. It's just much too leaky, right? So there's that issue of a priori assumptions and, you know, getting that right. How do you approach that problem? How big is that on your radar?
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, there's a couple of ways in which we approach it. First of all is we have what we call a confidence-based scoring mechanism. So we basically, we have four high-level pillars of inputs, which is tools, which I mentioned was one of them, credentials is another, behavior is another, and then infrastructure is another.
Tell us about that, because we haven't talked about that at all, have we, Vinny?
Yeah, and so because you can put all four things together, you get to a much better decision. And give you the infrastructure example. What's really nice is we look at all infrastructure that all of our customers use, i.e. the source from where people are coming from. And then we easily color code the infrastructure. We color code it either no color, which means it's fine, red, which means it's always used for bad stuff. So just, you know, you're fine to block it, but don't block whole ASNs. We've seen this in other customers and that's just ridiculous. That's from the 1980s. But then the yellow is the really interesting one. Because yellow is where the network sometimes behaves good and sometimes bad. And this is the kind of like the holy grail for attackers. They want to hijack residential proxies because they want to hide in plain sight and they want to come in through those, let's say, good networks. That's yours or my broadband services that they're trying to look like they're coming from. But what's really cool is that we have what we call fingerprinting technology. And this is why a lot of the times, like 98% of our customers end up putting us in line, even though we have a whole suite of passive solutions, because our fingerprinting basically looks at the tooling that's being used and small amount of behavioral analysis to make sure that we can run it in real time. And then fingerprints each collective of users coming through that are representing that tooling and behavioral combination is then an individual fingerprint. What this allows us to do is then say we can block different fingerprints or take other actions, might be rate limit, could be header inject, could be deceptive response. We then take those actions based on the fingerprint, not the IP address. And this is where a lot of antiquated systems get into trouble, is because they have to make a decision. Do they want to accept the false positives or the false negatives? Because they can't block those IP addresses, because, or they can, but then they're either going to get lots of calls into their help desk saying, hey, I'm blocked, or they're going to have, you know, challenges with their data and they have to put in other solutions elsewhere. Whereas we take that choice away. But then you do also have to be consultative with the customer, and the customer has to say, my appetite for false positives is this, or my appetite for false negatives is this. Because there's always going to be, especially in behavioral analysis, that little area somewhere in the middle where you're never going to be 100% sure. And in that case, the customer has to make a decision. And that doesn't have to be a global decision, by the way. That could be a per API decision, yeah. Could be an app decision, whatever. You know, it doesn't have to be like, you know, one size fits all.
Welcome to our workplace cybersecurity training. Our course is unique, flexible study, very high academic quality and high impact, especially built by an expert team of university professors to deliver the same standard of teaching you'd find at a top university, but for beginners. If you're interested and want us to be part of your journey to better company cybersecurity, contact us at Boudica, boudicasecurity.com.
You're listening to The Cyber Show.
Sounds like there's some great tools that you're developing. Tell us a little bit about Sequence, the history of the company, briefly what kind of products you have, and what you do as a system engineering director.
So Sequence is 10 years old, two co-founders, originally for bot defense. The big challenge was everything else solved the problem by injecting Java to the client side through an SDK or through the browser. But what that actually did was that gave the client all the controls and everything they needed to know on how to bypass it.
Yeah.
They basically solved that problem by becoming an invisible solution server-side. The interesting thing was, and the reason why they did that as well, is because there was the advent, even back then, of APIs becoming slightly more prevalent. With an API, the other thing they were solving was you couldn't inject JavaScript or an SDK into an API because there might not be anything to inject into. So therefore, it was an unsolvable problem. So what happened was, is immediately we were an API security platform, but in those days, there wasn't an API security platform buzz. So it was still at that point in time called a bot defense business. And that's right. Where all the behavioral analysis and all that originates from, is because the core technology was all about looking at behavior. And now what we look at resolving for people is our unified API protection platform. That solves three key problems: discovery, compliance, and protection. So discovery is, if you don't know where all your APIs are, you can't protect them. So discovery is the first phase, and that's an internal runtime discovery as well as an external discovery. So we come at it from two different angles. So we can crawl the internet looking for public-facing APIs, and we can be installed inside the business to look for all internal and public and even third-party APIs. Because one of the things we're finding is that the security risks aren't just with the APIs you're presenting, but they're with the ones you're consuming, GenAI being a very popular one of those.
Indeed.
So we're looking at all of the APIs that are going in and out of the business and understanding them. And then the check is, are they compliant? There's one of two ways of doing that, is either the developers provide us with the documentation automatically into our system, it gets imported, or If they don't have it, we automatically generate documentation from runtime information. And then we say, okay, this is the security platform from which we're going to adhere to and make sure that all strong authentication is in place, make sure there's no shadow APIs, make sure that sensitive data is only being exposed where it should be exposed. And then the relevant security controls are being put around that to make sure that everything is compliant. And you might want to be PCI compliant, DORA compliant, GDPR compliant. There's all kinds of compliance models out there in order to make sure you're running your business in the way that it's expected.
Obviously, you've got a range of different customers, and some customers out there would rather not be developing APIs wrong in the first place. So root cause analysis and going back into the development stage, this sounds really important. What kind of intelligence can you provide with your tools to help developers?
To hook directly into the developer's tooling and do tests at build time. We embed ourselves typically, if we can, into the CI/CD pipeline. We can go all the way left and into their IDE. That's more unusual to do that. Technically, it's entirely possible, but it seems like developers prefer us to be frictionless and inside of their CI/CD tooling. Mm. And what happens is at the time at which they do a new push through the CI/CD process, we're a stage within the pipeline, and what we do is we run as a stage, and then we run all of our tests against the API in question. So we'll look for sensitive data exposure, unauthenticated links, we'll do fuzzing tests. So does the API error or anything like that? So essentially, we'll do a whole bunch of attacks on the API to check that it's adhering, and we'll look at the documentation and make sure there's no shadow APIs being exposed and things like that. And then we'll report back into the pipeline whether the tests were a success or a failure, so that then they can fix it. But it's important, as you rightly mentioned, which is, you know, prevention is the best cure. So if you can go all the way back into the development stage, and that's a great time to catch problems. But of course, all businesses don't develop all of their APIs. So whilst it fits fantastically in the APIs they are developing, they'll have a whole bunch of other APIs that they're not developing.
Suddenly, things have happened that are really interesting. And one of them obviously is proliferation of new generation of bots. Bots just orders of magnitude faster, more intelligent, more adaptive than anything that we've ever seen before that were just scripts, really. Now we are truly in an arms race with machine versus machine. Who wins? Does compute win? Does throwing money at it win? Or does being a smarter designer win?
Oh, I don't know. That's a great question. A bit of a crystal ball gazing going on there. But I think there's no getting away. You need compute to be able to understand and build a lot of behavioral analysis. So compute is definitely a requirement. But then it's developer intelligence and how you consume that compute that's really, really important, and how you generate decisions. So the cool thing is like we can run all of our ML models and everything on our customer premises or in the cloud. But either way, you're going to need a reasonable, I would say, amount of compute for the control plane, the brains of the system, to make those choices. From a behavioral analysis perspective, if you're smart about it, the bit that you can control is the human behavior and what that looks like. That bit doesn't change. And what some people misunderstand is that speed isn't always a good thing, because humans are actually quite slow.
I saw the other day, it was like we process at 10 bits per second or something.
For a second, okay. Some of us, I might be slower, I'm not sure, but it's a really important element of actually, we see sometimes behavior of attacks. We literally do it based on time deltas. They did this, and this that quick. Of course, they'll start to slow down, they'll do lots of other things. So there's definitely an arms race going on here. And you rightly say it's not something you want to profiteer about, but what we do see is that there are API breaches every day. It's still not being taken seriously. So API security, ironically, even though it's in the news every day, people still think that they can solve it with their existing tooling. This arms race hasn't even begun in so many different places already, because actually there's more of an apathy or it won't happen to me approach.
How then are we going to raise awareness of API vulnerabilities? And obviously we're going to put out this Cyber Show episode. We'll have a few more people interested in the subject. What's your outreach? How do you get message out there?
Yeah, I mean, it's through all the normal channels of shows that we go to, events, you know, security forums. It's not that the security people on the ground don't understand the problems and don't see them. I think it's more of the budget holders that are saying, I'm not ready to invest in this. I got a great question the other day. The customer said to me, hey, I've got 57 cybersecurity products. Mm-hmm. Tell me why you should be number 58. And I think that's more the challenge that we're up against rather than, you know, people not understanding that there's security. It's the business when the risk is beyond acceptable.
Microsoft boasting that they had a department of like 1,500 people or something working on security, and the retort was, well, you know, if your product was good, you'd have none. And our job often as computer scientists, security people, whatever, we intend to make ourselves unemployed. And this is the beautiful irony that's been in tech since forever, is that you want to replace yourself with a very small shell script that eventually doesn't even need it anymore. You don't want to perpetuate the problem. You want to eliminate yourself. The ways that we eliminate ourselves, and I'm a big fan of Dana Meadows. I've been kind of into systems theory for like years, really love it. Cybernetics, as some people call it. I don't know if you've read the leverage points about where do you change the values, where do you intervene in a system? And one of the best ways is change the values in a system. You suddenly make whole swathes of defensive technology obsolete. You don't need to protect that anymore. So that can happen in changing laws, or it can happen in changing economic incentives and things like that. What do you think are the big solutions? Just kind of like getting into a bit of fun philosophy to the end. What will... In a world where there isn't cybersecurity, imagine like kind of 30 years in the future, what would that look like and why? What incentives for the attackers would have gone?
That's a great question. I think with AI, there is an opportunity to have any application learn for itself and defend itself and morph itself. I think every kind of external technology is never really as good as a native thing that's inside the application itself, understanding how it's being used and or abused, almost changing itself. So it says, you know, one day I'm written like this, the next day I'm gonna change the way I've actually been written so you can't exploit that flaw anymore. But from a consumer perspective, the application is like nothing's happened. Rewrote some code and changes the way in which it presents itself from under the hood. And I think there's a real opportunity. You stop patching systems, you actually fix it through morph, change, update to the system so that then that just doesn't exist anymore. And that'd be a much more secure model for me.
Interesting. So adaptive autonomous systems to which I can devolve security policy in some sense, and I can write my policy in broader strokes and then have it work out what I mean rather than what I said. One that description of APIs, I think this comes from Wikipedia, one of our defining sentences is, an API is often compared to a contract. It represents an agreement between parties. That's an interesting way of framing it.
Yeah.
Can we instruct our APIs to do what I mean and to fill in the gaps and be smart about what you egress and ingress?
Yeah, not today, but in the future, I can't see any reason why not. It seems like a problem that can be solved through AI. Having those much broader level constructs above means that you give AI the room to make those changes underneath to deliver the outcomes that you're looking for. And of course, security is typically all about outcomes. You know, today we talked a lot about technology responses, the way in which we defend, things like that. But from a business perspective, it's what's the outcome? The outcome is no one steals my data. That's it, right?
This is a really interesting bind that we're in now, because we'd like to solve a lot of things with machine learning. We'd like it to be able to adapt, to become autonomous, to take away the sweat of that labor. And then we're investing really serious decision making. That seems like a tasty cake and so fattening and dodgy at the same time. Yeah.
I think it's a way off being reality, right?
Is that where we're going? Do we want to go there? To flip that around, I'm the policy writer. I'm the person who, I'm the owner of the data. I'm the buck stops with me. How do you empower me as the responsible party? Give me tools that give me visibility and potential to act. Balance that with autonomous decision-making at the edge where I can't see it anymore.
Yeah, I think what you're touching on there is a real problem, which is, where is all my data? How does it get moved around? And what does that moving around look like, and what should it look like?
That's a really excellent summary, a three-line summary.
Yeah, and solving it's not so easy. But, so that's where you've got to use that kind of like discovery of all flows and wherever they're going, and knit them together. Problem is, for so long, security is focused on the perimeter, what enters and leaves the perimeter. Yep. The challenge with that is you lose all context.
Yeah.
So you've just lost entirely the context of where did it start, where did it come from, where did it go to, in between, before. Because if you just look at one gate, you can only judge me on my passport and the stamps that are in my passport. That's just missing a whole bunch of context.
Stella Remington, I think she headed MI5, most interesting. She had this aversion to national ID cards and ID documents. And I think she really gets something that's a deep philosophy that people miss, is that it's a fool's errand, really, to try and bind biological identity to predictive behavior, to use that as a marker for like what somebody may or may not do. Identity is actually quite weak. Behavior is a much more interesting thing to look at. As humans, we're mixed up with the bots. Like from a services or devices point of view, it doesn't know that you're a human or a bot. So if you're going to come up with a set of rules that you would apply to machines, you better be damn sure that you'd be happy with those being applied to human beings as well. Right, James, where can people contact you online?
Our website is www.sequence.ai. We're also on LinkedIn, sequence-security. We have 20,000 followers now. We're also on X with sequence.ai.
Fantastic. Is there anything else on your mind?
No, I think we've covered a lot today.
Great, that's what we like. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for your time.
Right, have a great rest of your day.
And yeah, you too.
All right, cheers, guys.
Bye.
Right, bye.
You're listening to The Cyber Show. The Cyber Show.